You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, the state legislature voted yesterday on whether employers can require vaccinations, who controls COVID-19 relief funds, and more. We'll get an update from our state capitol reporter. Right now, it's time for Wisconsin Life. This month marks the program's 10th anniversary here on WPR. As part of the celebration, here's producer Maureen McCollum sharing a story about a woman trying to improve the health of Milwaukee. It's part of an immigration project by Wisconsin Humanities, an organization that has partnered with Wisconsin Life for the last 10 years.
Cynthia Tejas Silva moved to the United States from Mexico on her 12th birthday. Her family eventually settled in Janesville, where she went to high school. Now, Tejas Silva works at 16th Street Community Health Centers in Milwaukee as the Healthy Schools Program Coordinator. Her long-term goal? To make the city healthier for everyone. Her story is being featured in the Wisconsin Humanities Traveling Exhibit, Immigrant Journeys from South of the Border. I recently caught up with Tejas Silva at South Shore Park in Milwaukee, where she told me more about her job.
So in my day-to-day job, right now, I do a lot of different videos. And I've been taking on a special project called Explorando Milwaukee, or Exploring Milwaukee, that aims to highlight a lot of the different green areas, trails, hidden spots where people can go and either walk to or exercise in. Or simply have a picnic at, like, in South Shore Park.
Hola, amigos. Bienvenidos a Explorando Milwaukee. Y hoy nos encontramos en el Parque South Shore.
Then the other ones is really helping support the Latinos por la Salud Facebook page. It's a group that the clinic and our community supports. It's made out of residents. And they have been taking on a project of cooking and showing these recipes on our website.
El día de hoy les voy a preparar una deliciosa sopa de tortilla con ingredientes.
Also, walking clubs and biking clubs. I'm very fond of those because on Wednesdays I get to ride with a lot of teenagers, youth from the community who come and are just ready to ride along. So we've been discovering different senderos, different trails like the Kinikinik. Once I see people that I haven't seen there, come. And then you see more people becoming aware of, like, oh, I didn't know this place was here, and I've been living here, like, my whole life. It's like, yeah, and, you know, and now I've been hearing some of these people speak Spanish a lot around me more than before. So I think that's a good sign that people are, you know, trying to get out there more.
Ahora sí, vamos a seguir con Jos Mari, disfrutando de la fiesta de aquí de Latinos por la Salud.
All of that to say that it's a very multi-dynamic job that I do, and I love it. It keeps me grounded, it keeps me in shape, which is great, and it keeps me healthy. So I always knew I wanted to be in a community health setting. I had a heart murmur when I was in high school. The only reason why I knew was because I had to get a physical done in order to join the soccer team, and there that was. And being in Janesville, I didn't see, like, another Latina woman, for example, like, talking to me or to my mom, explaining. I was like, okay, there's an exam that needs to be done. Okay, we got to get the exam done. I don't know what that exam is for, but so I think sometimes seeing the lack of explanation in some cases, and I think sometimes that includes, like, the language, it kind of made me aware of, hey, we need more people, you know, doing this. I think there's a lot of social change around us, and I said, what within my job or within my power, essentially, can I do to change systems? And how do we transform systems? I think my purpose is really to look at the health of a community or of the city. In this case, Milwaukee. I mean, I love Milwaukee. I'm very appreciative of everything that it has given me, but I also know that there's so much work to do. That's a dream job for me right now. And I think that has amplified my idea of what the health of the community looks like. Because now I'm not just looking at the community on the south side, but I'm looking at the whole city. And I think that has prompted me a little bit more thinking into, okay, what's next? I don't know. So, but I'm hopeful.
That was Cynthia Tejas Silva of Milwaukee. She's the Healthy Schools Program Coordinator at 16th Street Community Health Centers. Her story is also being featured in the Wisconsin Humanities Exhibit, Immigrant Journeys from South of the Border. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. I'm Maureen McCollum.
Wisconsin Humanities is holding a series of virtual conversations about immigration in conjunction with the Immigrant Journeys from South of the Border exhibit throughout this year. Now, the state legislature was in session yesterday, passing bills related to control of federal COVID-19 relief funds, whether governments and employers can require people to get vaccines, and more. Laurel White is WPR's state capitol reporter. She's here to round us up on the latest. Laurel, welcome back.
Hey, Rob. Thanks so much for having me.
Well, let's start with this question of vaccinations, whether they can be required by a government or private business. What bills were in the works there?
So there are two different bills. One would bar the State Department of Health Services and local health officials from requiring members of the public to get the vaccine. The second bill would bar employers from requiring their workers to get the vaccine. And according to memos written by the legislature's nonpartisan legal office, both of those things are technically feasible right now under state law with some limitations. The State Department of Health Services could do that through a mandate like we've seen, you know, many of during the pandemic, a measure that, you know, orders folks to do everything from, you know, stay home, not visit certain establishments, setting limits on capacity for certain establishments, for example. So they could do that under something like that. We're not aware of any such orders in Wisconsin right now. And employers could as well, with some limitations. There are protections under law for things like conscience objections, religious objections to vaccines, or if a person has a concern that they would be seriously hurt by a vaccine. So there are some protections in place, and that's something that Democrats brought up a lot during the debate, but it is technically possible for that kind of mandate to come down in Wisconsin.
And what were the arguments from the Republican supporters of this legislation?
They basically said that, you know, this isn't a role that government should be playing, requiring people to get vaccinations. A number of Republicans said, I plan to get vaccinated. I hope people will get vaccinated. I expect most Wisconsinites to get vaccinated. But it's not something that we should be mandating on people. It's not something that increases trust in public health to issue that sort of requirement. They said that some people might be concerned because of the type of authorization that the COVID-19 vaccines have, that emergency use authorization, not the full process that other vaccines that we get have been through. And they said, you know, this is just something that government shouldn't be involved in. So we're going to pass this protection to make sure that government and employers don't do such things.
And Laurel, a theme of some of the issues we're going to talk about here today, the Republicans in the legislature can pass them, the governor can veto them. Is the governor, have we heard anything from the governor or his people about whether he would veto these particular these particular laws banning vaccine mandates?
I've reached out to the governor's office a few times about these bills and haven't heard anything back yet. Only one of them has passed both chambers of the legislature. That's the proposal that would bar the government-mandated vaccinations. That passed the state assembly earlier this week and had passed the Senate in February. So that's on the governor's desk now, and he'll have to take an action one way or another on that. The bill barring employers from requiring vaccines has only passed the assembly. It hasn't been taken up in the Senate yet. So we're not quite to that stage where the governor is going to have to make a decision.
Also related to COVID, COVID-related relief funding from the federal government, Wisconsin and local governments getting $5+ billion of federal funding from the relief bill passed by Congress. And this issue of who gets to decide where that gets spent came up in the legislature yesterday. What's going on?
Essentially, what Republican lawmakers want is to give the state budget committee more say over how that federal funding is spent. Right now, Governor Evers and his administration have essentially full authority over how the money that comes into Wisconsin state government goes out, what initiatives it goes to, what sort of things are supported. And Republican lawmakers say that's really not how it should work. Lawmakers are involved in the state budget process. They're involved in a lot of other financial decisions involving the state. You know, you often talk about the legislative branch having the power of the purse. And they think this is such a substantial chunk of money that they want a seat at the table to determine where it goes in Wisconsin.
And that got some pushback from Democrats in the legislature. What did they argue in the contrary?
You know, it's interesting, Rob. It's a familiar argument that we've heard throughout the Evers administration about the balance of power, right? Republicans have argued in numerous instances that they haven't been given a seat at the table. The Republicans, or the governor rather, has kind of overstepped his bounds, overstepped his executive power. Democrats during this debate on this bill kind of turned the tables a little bit and said, now it's you, Republicans, it's the legislature. You guys are trying to enable us to overstep our power. This is something that the executive should be able to do. They should be able to direct money from the federal government. And this really isn't our ballgame. This isn't something we should get involved with.
Laurel White is with us, WPR State Capitol reporter, rounding up some of the action in the state legislature this week. Also some work on elections oversight and investigations. This isn't a bill exactly that would go to the governor, as I understand it, Laurel, but saying, hey, we're going to have our committees look into the 2020 elections.
That's right. So this is a resolution that basically empowers an assembly committee to look into elections in Wisconsin since 2019, how they've been administered, any potential problems there. And the reason that lawmakers are taking this up or took this up and approved it as a resolution was because there's a possibility that lawmakers might need to issue subpoenas to get information from certain individuals involved with elections in Wisconsin. And to get that subpoena power, they needed to pass a resolution in the legislature. It's important to note that they've actually already had a couple hearings on this investigation that Republicans have called for into the election. So this is a process that's kind of already out of the gate, but they said that they wanted, assurance that they could have that additional tool, and the resolution gave them that.
What kind of things are they focusing on? We heard a lot of accusations back after the 2020 election, nothing that ended up holding up in courts. What are they focusing on?
So they're focusing on a few things. I think one of the big themes that we'll see continue to play out, and there's going to be some legislation about this in the coming session, is the difference between state laws related to elections and some policies that have been established by the Wisconsin Elections Commission, whether the Elections Commission has gone too far in establishing policies, if those aren't accurate reflections of what law should be, and how municipal clerks were administering the election, kind of on a really granular level. And so, you know, we talked a lot about things like witness signatures on absentee ballots and clerks being able to fill in missing information if they had that information from a reliable official government document, stuff like that. Really the kind of detail work that goes into elections in Wisconsin.
And briefly, Laurel, to-go cocktails at Wisconsin bars and restaurants. Give us 30 seconds on what's going on there.
So this one would allow licensed bars and restaurants to sell cocktails to go, glasses of wine to go. This isn't something that they've been able to do in the past. And restaurant groups have really pushed for this, saying that it would be a very helpful revenue stream during the pandemic when they've really taken a hit in alcohol sales in particular, which are very good for revenue generation for restaurants and bars, because people aren't dining in. So this is a measure, something that supporters say the legislature can do to help the food and drink industry in the state.
Laurel, thanks a lot for joining us.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Laurel White is WPR State Capitol reporter. She talked with us about bills passed by the state assembly yesterday that would give the legislature control over federal relief funds and prevent employers and local governments from requiring people to get vaccinated. Governor Evers might veto some or all of those if they come to his desk. Coming up, we'll hear from people around the state reflecting on their experience during the COVID-19 pandemic. That's next on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, a Madison woman is being praised for her generosity after returning a library book that was way, way, way overdue. We'll talk to her about what happened and the attention she's been getting. Now, over the last year, WPR and Wisconsin Watch have documented the lives of Wisconsinites in this unprecedented time with a series of audio diaries called Outbreak Wisconsin. A year into the pandemic, we asked them to listen back to their early diaries and reflect. Bram Sable-Smith has more.
Mariah Clark is an emergency department nurse at UW Health in Madison, where the state's first COVID-19 patient was treated last year.
I'll never forget that first COVID patient. I'd been reading about COVID in the news for a month at that point, but when that first case rolled into the department, I remember having that sensation of, oh, shit. It's here. And wondering how it was going to change everything. It's been a strange year of dualities. There were aspects of COVID that let us really connect back to the fact that we as nurses are there to care for whole people and not just assemblages of parts that aren't working right at the time. And I think in some ways, you know, the terror of the disease also let us regain a little bit of that odd humanity too, because we had seen friends or family or coworkers who had gotten ill. We could picture ourselves there. And it felt a lot of the time a lot more human.
When Jessica Barrera revisits her thoughts from early in the pandemic, she can't help but recall her anxiety. She spent months waiting for unemployment assistance after she lost her job in Eau Claire.
There were so many unknowns. There was so much that was out of my control. It makes me feel tired almost to hear myself. I think a year ago, most of us were just surviving day to day, emotionally, mentally, physically, financially, just to get through to the next day. And if I could talk to myself a year ago, or if I knew then what I know now, I would let her know that you get used to wearing a mask. It's not so weird after the first little while. And to just keep your faith that things will get better.
Amy Moreland of Madison was laid off from her job as a bartender last March. She was unemployed for nearly a year before deciding to go back to school.
A lot has changed in that year. I like to think about, like, you know, sometimes just imagining being, like, older, like, you know, and talking to, like, grandkids about this time that we survived and how we're, like, kind of living through history right now and telling our grandkids about, you know, the quarantine and all this and it being something that we got through. And I don't know what I hope is different about next year is I hope that I am thriving again. You can truly be excited about everything that's coming and grieve the things that have passed as well. So that's where I'm at right now is I'm really excited for the future, but I do feel a sense of sadness for the things that I've lost as well. And I do grieve the past because it's never going to be exactly the same.
Adija Greer-Smith owns Confectionately Yours, a Milwaukee bakery that had to shut its doors for several months.
It's so hard to believe even now that we're a year into this pandemic and we, you know, our kids are still home and we're living in masks. But, you know, I personally think that we may be this way for a while. 2020 was just catastrophic in so many ways. But for Confectionately Yours, I would say the later part of the year was really good to us. You know, it opened up so many doors of opportunity. You know, one thing that I knew coming into entrepreneurship was that I had to go through a process. Clearly, this was a part of that process. Had I opened my business 10 years ago, I may not have experienced this obstacle. But this process really made me stronger. My hope for just people is that this year would have taught us all to love more and hate less, because life is so very precious.
86-year-old Door County resident Beverly Bleets struggled with isolation throughout the year. Now, she has a new outlook.
Well, on my walk today, I felt satisfaction and the joy of the coming of spring. At the same time, it's hard for me to believe that we'll soon observe the first anniversary of the recognition of the existence of the pandemic. The older I get, the faster the time passes. But the urgency, the threat, the fright of the tragedy that is COVID have been replaced in my life with a more peaceful resolution. A year ago, I grieved that time was being snatched from me, that the loss of the old normal meant the loss of so much that was meaningful in my life. But with the passing of the year, instead, I learned to direct my thinking and to better understand the virtue of the new normal and its restrictions. More than ever, the importance of my family and relationships has taken precedence over the more frenzied activity of a daily calendar. I am content to be who I am and where I am in time. It is with profound gratitude that, so far, I am privileged to enjoy yet another coming of spring.
To hear more stories like this one, visit WPR.org/outbreakwisconsin. Coming up, meet the Madison woman who made international news for returning a library book that was more than 60 years overdue. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we received an audience question about Wisconsin's artist environments and why there are so many of them in the state. We'll get some answers from an art researcher and a curator of a new preserve for this unique kind of art. Now let's go back in time for a moment. The year 1957, the USSR launches Sputnik 1. The final new episode of I Love Lucy airs on CBS. American Bandstand premieres 3 months later. The first Frisbee toys go on sale. And in an eerie coincidence, the Asian flu pandemic begins. And July 10th, 1957 is when the book Old Paul, The Mighty Logger by Glenn Rounds was due back at the Queens Public Library, but it wasn't returned. Until last month, more than 63 years later, along with a $500 donation for the trouble. Turns out the person who had it all this time lives here in Wisconsin, and now her story is being told all over the country, even outside the U.S. Betty Diamond is a Madison resident, playwright and director for the Madison Theater Guild. She's the one who checked out Old Paul when she was 10 years old. Betty, thanks a lot for joining us today.
It's my pleasure.
Well, I know you've done tons of interviews about this. Betty, thanks for being up for doing one more. Start us off with the story. You check out the book. Why didn't you return it way back then?
As far as I recall, the reason I didn't return it was I had let it get overdue, and I was just like too embarrassed to return it. And so as a 10-year-old might figure out, well, then let's just pretend it didn't happen. And so I just never returned the book.
Now, if I'd hung on to a book at age 10, I'm pretty sure I would have lost it or disposed of it somehow by now. How did you still have it 5 dozen plus years later?
Well, I like books. I tend to keep them. And, you know, it was on my bookcase. It was a pretty little book. It had a red cover and black and white illustrations. You know, it was a hardback. And, yeah, it just stayed with me, as do many of my books.
Now, in my head, this is like, you know, the telltale heart was at Poe. And this thing is just the guilt of this book is nagging at you for years and years. What finally drove you over the top to return it?
Well, it's not exactly that it was in my consciousness.
Well, I may have over-dramatized.
But, well, you know, people ask me that, and the answer is truly, I don't know. It was just that I was having a discussion with some friends about making amends. And, you know, I had thought about the book on and off because it was on a bookcase and I would see it. And every now and again, I would just go, I really should return that book. And finally, this time it was like, okay, I'm ready. I'm going to do it. So, yeah.
And you'd made a donation, you know, the late fees and then some.
Well, but we do know that the fines, a lot of libraries no longer charge their fines, especially during the pandemic. But I mean, I was quite aware that the fines don't continue on for 63 years. They usually just reach a certain replacement value. So this was more a donation of affection for the institution of the public library.
I got to ask this. You're a kid reading this in the Queens Public Library in New York City. You're reading a book about Paul Bunyan. You end up in Wisconsin. I mean, did the book inspire you to seek us out here?
No, but it was really funny because I was at UW, and it was really funny when I, went to the student union, and there was this huge mural of Paul Bunyan and Babe the Blue Ox. And I finally like put two and two together. It's like, oh my God, this is the area where those stories took place.
Talking to Betty Diamond of Madison, she recently got a lot of attention returning a 63-year overdue library book to a library in New York. Okay, Betty, let's get to part two of this story. You sent the book back. You sent this donation, and I'm guessing you thought that would be the end of it. How did you go from there to international phenomenon?
Beats me. It's really, really, yeah. So the library foundation that I had made the checkout to asked me if I would be willing to do some interviews with, the press. And I said, sure, thinking this would be, you know, part of my making amends. I would help them fundraise, perhaps. But I really thought that it would be like, you know, some local Queens newspaper or the library newsletter. And then the communications director said she was going to pitch it to the New York Times. And I just laughed. And I said, the Times is not going to want this story. And she said, well, we'll start there. And then I get this call, and the Times wanted the story. And it was like, all right, you know, it was bewildering, all the attention that it got.
Yeah, the Times, our friends at As It Happens on CBC, which you can hear from 7 to 8 here on the Ideas Network, the thing really snowballed. Do you have how many interviews have you done since that first one with the Times?
A few, not a huge number, because at a certain point it was like, thank you, no. And what was fun was, well, first of all, I was just laughing a lot because, like, when I got the call from the CDC, it was like, seriously? Really? Okay. And then I would be getting all of these texts from friends like, you're on the front page of the Wisconsin State Journal. And I got calls from my cousins in Florida saying, we just saw you in the Sunday Times, you know, and another friend from Minneapolis says that I was in the Minneapolis Star Tribune, and it was nuts. Oh, and then some of my favorite things, people were just sending me all these emails and stuff, and this friend of mine in San Francisco sent me like a newsletter from the San Francisco Book Festival, and there was a link to the article in that, you know, and it's just, yeah, it's... It's a tad bewildering, but okay.
Now, I understand, Betty, you are still a library user. You routinely check out materials from your library, not in Queens anymore, but in Madison.
Yes, that is true.
Any recommendations? What have you read lately that that we want to know about a star like you reading and that we want to read ourselves?
Well, I've just, you know, this is pandemic reading. Mm-hmm. So I, for the first time, started reading, I believe they're called Danish Noir Murder Mysteries. And so that's been my latest fad.
And now, old Paul, 63 years later, would you recommend it? Was it worth the wait?
Sure. Oh, here's another thing. So the publishers of old Paul, yes, contacted the New York Times to ask for my contact information. And they are sending me an anniversary edition of one of the books by the same author.
Oh, funny.
I know. But here's one other thing that I just do want to say, and that is that really gratifies me. And I got, I was talking to the Queen's Library folks, and they said that since the article came out, they've been getting a lot of donations. And that was the reason I've done the interviews. So here's a plug. Madison Library, Wisconsin Libraries, they can use the money.
That's a good place to leave it, Betty. Thank you so much for sharing your story with us.
You're very welcome.
That's Betty Diamond, Madison resident, playwright and director for the Madison Theater Guild. And we talked to her about the book she returned to the Queens Public Library 63 years late, the donation she included, and all the media attention she's received since, including from us. Coming up, have you ever driven to the Dickeyville Grotto, found your way to Fred Smith's Wisconsin Concrete Park? The state has a lot of artist-built environments like these, and we're going to try to find out why. That's coming up next here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up today at 6 on 1A+, join Jen White and America's 14th Librarian of Congress as they reveal this year's new inductees into the National Recording Registry, America's Audio Hall of Fame. That's today at 6 on 1A+. Now, we recently received a question from a listener, Chris Murphy from Madison.
My question is, why are there a higher concentration of outsider artist environments in Wisconsin than anywhere else in the U.S.?
To help answer this why Wisconsin question, we called up a couple of experts in the area. Courtney Anderson Kramer is a PhD candidate in the UW-Madison Department of Art History, specializing in concrete sculpture gardens in the Midwest. Courtney, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks so much for having me.
And Laura Bickford is associate curator at the John Michael Kohler Arts Center, with duties including curating the new art preserve for artist-built environments in Sheboygan. Laura, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Well, Courtney, let's start off with a description, a definition. What is an outsider artist's environment?
Wow, that is a really great question. In general, a outsider art environment is going to be a space that is an artwork that is monumental in terms of its size and the amount of time that took to make, but also it can be monumental in the number of parts. So we're talking about, you mentioned, the Wisconsin Concrete Park. Well, there are hundreds of sculptures on this site that the artist Fred Smith created over the course of decades. So that's a great sort of simple definition of what this sort of space is.
And you have done a lot of work on looking at these around the Midwest. Why are there so many of these in the Midwest and here in Wisconsin in particular?
So that's also a really good question. And there's some truth and some not so truth to that. Ah. You can find these sorts of artworks anywhere in the world. But there are organizations in the Midwest, especially in the state of Wisconsin, like the Kohler Foundation, that has done a great job of taking care of these sites, of recognizing their value and preserving them. But then there is some truth to it that there are a lot here, and that's owing to kind of tourism at the time. You think of around the 30s and 40s when these are being made, we're seeing lots of tourism to the Dells, to Door County, and homeowners are kind of capitalizing on this traffic, creating artworks, sculptures that are driving people to their homes.
And Laura, let's bring you in on this now. Why is it important to recognize and preserve these kind of unique art environments?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's the same reason to preserve these as there is to preserve sort of any work of art. I think they're a prime example of a cultural contribution, you know, to a country or nation. But I think specifically, you know, these sort of art environments, I like to think of them as, you know, a genre-busting genre, where they're really made by people across walks of life who ordinarily maybe wouldn't feel that they were able to make works of art or wouldn't have access to a museum. And so they really represent, in some instances, some parts of life from the perspective of a maker that I think normally wouldn't have work in a museum or wouldn't have work that people would see, you know, sort of in the halls of an arts institution. And so they can really speak to a kind of everyday vernacular, sort of really true way of the way that people are living on the land that they're living on.
And Laura, you at the John Michael Kohler Arts Center have this exhibit, this space, and this sounds like a real challenge to me because you can't take this and, you know, oh, I just need a few square feet of wall space to exhibit these things. Can you talk about the challenges of putting these out there for the public to see and preserving them?
Yeah, I mean, our collection of artist-built environments has work by over 32 different artists, both from the United States and then one artist from India. And all of the work, you know, was made somewhere else and designed to be in that other place forever. So we're already starting out with this work that doesn't really belong necessarily even inside or certainly not in a museum. And so we've just built a new building. It's 56,000 square feet to house our collection that will now be permanently on view in what we're calling a sort of state of visible storage. So it's a mixture of kind of what people might expect in an exhibition, but then also sort of open racks, open painting racks, sort of glass shelves where people can see kind of objects at rest. There's kind of peeks into the conservation workshop and the exhibition workshop. So it is really a kind of working, functioning museum storage space that also happens to be open to the public where people can come and learn about this form of art.
Talking to Laura Bickford from the John Michael Kohler Arts Center and Courtney Anderson Kramer, PhD candidate in the UW-Madison Department of Art History, answering a Why Scotsman question about art environments in Wisconsin and a little bit beyond, too, why they are popular here, what they are, and how they came to be. And Courtney, you look a lot at concrete sculpture gardens, and a big part of the story was this innovation where concrete became readily available to the masses, homeowners, anybody who wanted to do whatever they wanted to with it. Can you talk about how people started getting creative with this new, I think, cheaply available technology?
Absolutely. So today we go to Menards, right? We pick up a garden border that's ready-made to put into our gardens. But at this time, you know, the 20s, 30s, even into the 40s, people are going, they're getting a bag of cement, and they're creating a garden border. They're creating a bird bath. They're creating bird houses out of concrete. And so it's very much a part of gardening itself, using the concrete in the garden to make your garden beautiful. It just so happens that these artists really sort of were bitten with the concrete bug and just continued to grow in their confidence in how they created with concrete, creating sculptural spaces, architectural spaces, adding concrete to their homes. And so, yes, absolutely, concrete became more available. Periodicals were providing instructions to homeowners on how to use it to beautify their homes and continued to even further to encourage people to be creative and artistic with the way that they use the concrete.
And Laura, can you name some names of people who have done this and maybe that are on exhibit at your site or ones that you make a detour to see yourself?
Yeah, for sure. I think that's what is sort of unique about what we could say about Wisconsin or even the upper Midwest environments is the kind of preponderance of concrete and embellished concrete. And at the Art Preserve, the whole sort of first floor is dedicated to kind of unpacking this and showing examples of these environments from the upper Midwest, the majority of which feature concrete. So we have representations of the artist Fred Smith, who was mentioned, whose site still exists in Phillips, the Wisconsin Concrete Park. We have representations of Nick Engelbert's work, whose site also still exists, called Grandview in Hollandale, Wisconsin. We have the work of Peter Jodacy, a kind of lesser-known concrete artist who had a site in Michigan. We have the really beautiful grotto by a woman named Madeline Buell from Dubuque, Iowa. That's just some of them. I won't give them all away. But I will say that because we live in Wisconsin, I would encourage everyone to take a road trip. There's a group of sites that still exist that, you know, are organizations that preserve sites like this in situ all over the state, which just means they're sited. They are still where they were made. And there's, you can get a map from online and download it, and you can take a trip all around the state and see all of these sites where they were made, and then come to the Art Preserve in Sheboygan and see a little sample of each of them.
Now, Courtney, I hate to do this to you, but can you pick one site that you recommend people see, or maybe an out-of-the-way one, and kind of paint us a picture of what we see if we take the time to go there?
Absolutely. You know, perhaps one of the more popular ones that hasn't been mentioned so far is the Dickeyville Grotto. And it's so well-known and so well-established within this kind of network of art environments because it influenced so many other creators. It influenced folks in Cochrane, Wisconsin. It influenced Madeline Buell, who Laura just mentioned. And so when you go there, it's built up at a Catholic church. It is a monument to patriotism as well as Catholicism. And it is a sort of architectural grotto shrine that is encrusted with everything from geodes and rocks to what is recorded to be Ford gear shift knobs. The texture of the space is just stunning. It's like walking into a gem. It's beautiful. So I would highly recommend that because it really did shape influence a lot of other artists in the region. Personally, my favorite is the Rudolph Grotto Garden in Rudolph, Wisconsin. It is a beautiful sprawling garden. It was once a flat plot of farmland that's transformed into this woodland, and it is absolutely stunning.
And Laura, sticking with the visuals for the moment, can you walk us through what we experience if we see your exhibit, your art preserve at the Kohler Art Center?
Yeah, I mean, it's a really incredible building that was designed sort of to house our collection. And it sort of fits into a hill. So despite it being three stories on every level, you're sort of still on ground level, which I think makes for these really interesting vistas in the building. So in a kind of single view, you really can take in the spectrum of these environments. So if you know, at one point you'll see an entire house that was encrusted in glitter that was made by a man named Loy Boland from Macomb, Mississippi. And sort of beyond that house, you can see a monumental painting rack of hundreds of paintings by an artist named Gregory Van Manen from New Jersey, who primarily paints skulls and kind of amulets and talismans. Kind of beyond that, tucked into the corner is the studio of the fiber artist Lenore Tani, and she was very into Zen Buddhism and meditation, and so it's all whites and ethereal fabrics and natural stones kind of stacked with wood furniture and really sumptuous leather chairs. So it's really hard. I hope it's definitely a feast for the eyes, and it's hard to create a single picture, but there really is a wide variety of kind of materials and expressions, and it's really designed to kind of pique curiosity, and you don't know what you'll find around every corner when you walk through.
And Courtney, before I let you go, I should ask, you've studied these things and track them around the state. Have you gotten your hands into the concrete yourself?
Not yet. I am a gardener through and through, so it's inevitably going to happen someday.
And Laura, can you let us know, is there a good way to find these outside of the Kohler Art Center, a good way to find these around the state?
Yeah, besides kind of downloading the Wandering Wisconsin map, which will really clearly show you how to get to these sites that are cared for by nonprofits, I would always say the best way is to never take the highway, and you'll never know what you'll find when you take the long way around. And that's often where these sites are that are less documented today, kind of off the beaten path. So I always say, you know, budget a day. The travel day should be the first day of your trip, and you should map yourself off the highway.
We'll leave it there. Laura, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you.
And Courtney, thanks for being with us.
Thanks so much.
That was Courtney Anderson Kramer, PhD candidate in art history at UW-Madison, and Laura Bickford, curator of the new Art Preserve for Artist-Built Environments at the John Michael Kohler Art Center in Sheboygan. We talked to them about artist-built environments and why there are lots of them here in Wisconsin. This came from an audience question as part of the Why Wisconsin Project. Submit your question and we might answer it in a future story. Go to WPR.org/Wisconsin. Weekdays from 6 to 9 a.m., it's The Morning Show. Tomorrow at 7, an investigative reporter shares a long-running investigation of sexual assault and harassment in Wisconsin's National Guard. Coming up next, it's news. Then, it's our Week in Washington. We'll look at the ongoing response of the Biden administration to an increase in children arriving at the southern border with Mexico. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network.